Okay. Well, it's always great to be at KITP. I think you've all had ample opportunity to see my introductory slide. So the main thing I'm going to try to do in this talk is explain the basis for cosmic ray hydrodynamics. In other words, this fluid theory of cosmic rays as a relativistic gas coupled to the thermal gas despite being virtually collisionless. So I'll very quickly go over the observational motivation for this picture. And then I'll talk about two versions of cosmic ray hydrodynamics. One of which is the self-confinement picture, which is sort of the classical version. And the other is an extrinsic turbulence picture, which I don't think can be ruled out in many situations. Along the way, I'll say a little bit about the effect of magnetic fields and background gas properties, although this is kind of a big subject. And then, so this part of the talk will be heavily loaded with equations. And then at the end, I'll talk about application, both to galactic winds and to heating of the interstellar medium. And I'll say a little bit about how cosmic rays can be used as a probe of star formation and other conditions in galaxies. So here's the only observational slide. Oh, and I am happy to be interrupted, as I'm sure you all know. Okay, so the main observations are that cosmic rays have a sort of broken power law spectrum in energy. In the GeV range up to about 3 PeV, which is the range we're going to be interested in, it's e to the minus 2.6. The average energy over this distribution is about 3 GeV, so mildly relativistic protons. In the Milky Way, the cosmic ray magnetic and thermal energy densities are roughly an equipartition, all about 1 eV per cubic centimeter. Cosmic rays are directionally isotropic as they arrive at the Earth to between a tenth and a hundredth of a percent. They get slightly more anisotropic as we go up in energy. They're confined, so we know this from a combination of spallation products, in other words, grammage, and decay of radioactive isotopes. They're confined to the galaxy for about 20 million years, and they cross something like 3 to 5 grams per square centimeter on their way to being detected at the Earth, which can be converted to a mean density of about 1/10 of an atom per cubic centimeter.
So when I say confined, can you define
Yes, that when a cosmic ray is born, it resides in the galaxy for about 20 million years on the average.
But that's based on measurement from Earth. So on average, it's 20 million years before the cosmic ray is born and it hits the Earth's atmosphere. It doesn't say anything about the galaxy.
If we look at the synchrotron emission, they seem to occupy a thick disk. The scale height of the synchrotron emissivity is about 1.5 kiloparsecs. So our surmise is that the cosmic rays that that we see in the galactic plane are filling this thicker volume. And we can say. Oh, so where does this 20 million years come from? It comes from.
What is the number? What this number is, 20 million years?
It's
a time between what and what?
Oh, so the 20 million years is based on decay of some radioactive isotopes of, I think, boron 10. It's an old measurement. So the isotopic ratio, and I don't remember the details of this, but the isotopic ratio suggests that the time between acceleration and detection is about 20 million years. It's an old paper by.
So it's not the confinement time in the galaxy. It's a time for cosmic rays to hit the Earth's atmosphere. It doesn't do with the galaxy at all.
What alternative are you proposing?
No, I'm just asking. I'm trying to understand what this number actually is.
If it stayed in the galaxy for that long, that means it had to scatter a lot. Based on what we think, and so that means it's sampled a large fraction of the volume in the galaxy, right? I mean, that's the argument.
I'm not sure how the volume is related to the time it takes for the cosmic ray to keep that atmosphere.
Well, because it's not streaming right towards us.
Yeah, but you're going to have a supernova like 10 parsec away, 10 parsec much smaller in the galaxy. and then get the cosmic ray scattered multiple times in another direction around the Earth, it would be travel time of 10 parsec, not the way to go.
I don't think that's what they're doing.
So
they're,
it's the com- yeah, so it's
an isotopic decay. It's an isotopic ratio you've seen in the interstellar medium.
No, these are cosmic rays.
No, but I mean, you're saying the cosmic ray particles.
The measured isotopic ratio.
Abundance in the cosmic
rays.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there are people who model the transport of cosmic rays in our galaxy in extreme depth in these leaky box models. And, right, I mean, to get the 10 to the 7 to work out, you'd know better than me, but, I mean, wasn't it, I mean, don't you need them to sample a substantial fraction of the volume?
Yeah, so the 3 to 5 grams per square centimeter comes from the overabundance of light elements, lithium, beryllium, boron, which are most easily explained as spallation products of collisions between CNO cosmic ray nuclei and interstellar protons.
Well, I understand this number. I have no objection.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to understand what I understand the second number. I don't understand what the first number is.
Oh, you don't understand this number.
Yeah, just
20
what
million
is
years.
The definition of this confined for? What does it mean physically confined?
Oh, that the time between acceleration and detection at the Earth is 20 million years on average.
But then why is it confined? Nothing to do with confinement, right? It just,
well, it's much longer than the light travel time across the galaxy. That's what Shane was saying. Okay, maybe we could get back to this. Well, maybe we could get back to this. If you could suspend disbelief or whatever. So the composition is similar to interstellar composition. In other words, it's not our process composition. So cosmic rays are probably accelerated in the interstellar medium. They're not supernova ejecta. As I said a few minutes ago, they occupy a thick disk similar to the distribution of warm ionized gas in the galaxy. And there's this very robust far infrared radio correlation that holds for many galaxies that seems to be saying something about the cosmic ray populations in other galaxies. So because of the long confinement times and near isotropy, people have evolved theories of diffusive transport for cosmic rays. And the assumptions that go into the theory are that there's a well-defined magnetic field that varies very little over a cosmic ray gyro orbit. So the cosmic ray gyro radius in galactic magnetic fields is about this, 2/10 of an AU for a particle with 1 GeV of energy in a magnetic field of 1 microgauss. There are drifts across the field, but they're very slow. They're basically the ratio of the gyro radius to the scale on which the magnetic field varies. So the particles are well tied to the field lines. Of course, if the field were completely chaotic, this would have to be relaxed. And in addition to being tied to the field lines, they diffuse up and down the field lines, and the field lines themselves wander. So we know from observations that the galactic magnetic field has a substantial random component, and the cosmic rays sort of wander along these wandering field lines, and this leads to a kind of compound diffusivity. So lambda here is the cosmic ray mean free path to scattering. I haven't said what they scatter from yet. And lambda b is the kind of correlation length of the magnetic field. So if the mean free path is short for the cosmic rays, then the diffusivity is set by their mean free path. And if the magnetic correlation length is short, the diffusivity is set by the magnetic correlation length. And empirically, the mean free path in the Milky Way for GeV cosmic rays is thought to be about 1 parsec, and this implies a diffusivity of about 10 to the 28 to 10 to the 29 centimeters squared per second. Okay, so what actually is the scattering mechanism? So the favorite theory is that it's gyroresonant pitch angle scattering. And the idea is that if you have fluctuations with some frequency omega and wave number k along the magnetic field, and here mu is the cosine of the particle pitch angle, defined like this, and n is an integer, and omega c is the relativistic gyro frequency, then the particle will see this fluctuation at a fixed phase, and it will interact strongly with it. And if you sum over many uncorrelated small angle scatterings, you can derive a mean scattering rate, nu, which is basically the cyclotron frequency of the particle times the relative energy in fluctuations compared to the energy of the magnetic field, the mean magnetic field. Okay. And you can put these fluctuations, and we haven't really said anything about their nature yet or where they come from, into a sort of Fokker-Planck equation if these inequalities are satisfied. So the gyro period is very short, so we average over the gyro phase. The scattering time is longer than the cyclotron time, but much shorter than the kind of dynamical time, characteristic time over which the distribution evolves. And so that leads to the following collision operator in the Vlasov equation for cosmic rays. So we sum over waves going in the positive and negative directions. W here is the sum of the fluid velocity and the velocity of the waves of so far unspecified nature. And so there's this pitch angle scattering term, which conserves energy. And then there's this term, which depends on momentum. And this is called a Compton-Getting term. And it basically accounts for the need to transform between the frame of the waves and the frame of the observer. So all that's assumed in deriving this equation is that there are scattering centers with a well-defined velocity moving either in positive or negative directions along the field lines, and that the rate of scattering satisfies these inequalities.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So the V wave here, so this must be, I guess, tied to the average, the scale you're averaging over, right? Because this is eventually going to become the Alphane speed, I guess. So I guess I'm just trying to think, you know, so is this the scale on which you compute that, Matt? I mean, if it's small.
Yeah, scale. So there's in addition to the temporal Fokker-Planck ordering, there's a spatial Fokker-Planck ordering, which I should have mentioned. So the idea is that there's a length scale which is intermediate between the global length scales and the scales of the individual waves. Yeah, yeah.
Good. And so you're basically, that's the average of the B field, or the...
Yeah, so the fluid flow, so the fluid flow would be averaged over many mean-free paths, but still short compared to a global scale. Yeah, good, thank you. Okay, so it's possible to derive an equation for momentum transfer by taking that Fokker-Planck equation, multiplying it by the parallel momentum, and integrating over momentum space. And that leads to this. It says that the time rate of change of the mean parallel momentum density in the cosmic rays is minus the gradient of the parallel gradient of the cosmic ray pressure minus this drift term. So nu here is a composite scattering frequency. It's the sum of the positive and negative scattering frequencies averaged over cosmic ray pitch angle. This is the mean drift of the cosmic rays. This is the mean wave velocity, and this is the cosmic ray density. So what the scattering term tries to do is it tries to drive the distribution function toward isotropy in the frame of the waves. And in a steady state, in other words, when the left-hand side here is zero, the acceleration down the pressure gradient will balance the friction. So the way we interpret this is that the frictional drag of cosmic rays exerted on cosmic rays by the waves can be equated to the parallel gradient of cosmic ray pressure. Okay, so that's momentum transfer. Now, let me say a little bit about energy transfer. So to derive the energy transfer, we take that Fokker-Planck equation and we average it over pitch angle, mu. So the philosophy here is that cosmic rays are almost isotropic. There's a small anisotropy. And we call the isotropic part of the distribution capital F. And I left out a parenthesis here. It obeys this equation. So there's this sort of, there are these kind of advection and compression terms. And then there's this collision operator. And the collision operator has two pieces. It has spatial diffusion, d parallel, which is defined here. And it has diffusion in momentum space. So, and u is the fluid velocity plus an average over the wave velocities, positive and negative wave velocities, weighted by the scattering frequencies. So it has this definition. Notice that diffusion in momentum space requires both positive and negative propagating waves, and this term corresponds to Fermi acceleration. So if you think of the picture of stochastic Fermi acceleration, particles bounce off moving magnetic mirrors, and that requires that the mirrors be going in both directions in order to have net, in order to have second order acceleration. Okay, so if we take this equation and multiply by the energy, and I'm going to use the ultra-relativistic approximation here, but you don't have to, and we integrate over momentum space, and we ignore the Fermi term for now, then we get this equation for the behavior of the cosmic ray energy density. And this is pretty much what you would expect for a relativistic diffusive gas that has this velocity, fluid velocity, plus some wave velocity. So there's the convective derivative, partial partial t plus u dot grad. Then there's this compression term, and this 4/3 here is more generally the adiabatic index of the cosmic rays. And then we have this spatial diffusion term. So the cosmic ray energy density evolves according to this. Okay, so now let's see, couple that to the background. So if we take the ideal fluid equations for continuity, momentum, and energy, and we assume the fluid is polytropic, we can derive this energy conservation theorem. So here's the time rate of change of energy density, kinetic, thermal gas, cosmic ray gas, and that's equal to minus the divergence of a flux plus another term, Q. And that flux is the kinetic energy flux and the enthalpy flux of the thermal gas, so being advected at velocity V. And then the cosmic ray flux is enthalpy-like, but it's not convected at V, it's convected at U. And then there's the spatial transport term. And so Q, the heating rate, is this mean wave velocity dotted with the gradient of cosmic ray pressure. Okay. So we can't put it off any longer. What is the velocity of the waves, this average velocity of the waves? So in the self-confinement picture, these waves are Alphane waves, and they're amplified by super Alphane cosmic rays that flow down their pressure gradient. And in that case, Q is positive. There's net heating. And the magnitude of Q is the Alphane speed times the parallel gradient of cosmic ray pressure. In the extrinsic turbulence picture, the waves are produced by an MHD cascade. They have nothing to do with the cosmic rays. And if the turbulence is balanced, so you have equal numbers of waves propagating in opposite directions, then Q is actually zero. There is no net velocity of the wave frame. So there would be no cosmic ray heating. If you had imbalanced turbulence, so for example, if you had MHD waves streaming out of the galactic plane and cosmic rays streaming. Thanks, Shane. And cosmic rays streaming out of the galactic plane, then the waves and the cosmic rays would be going in the same direction, and there could be a similar picture to the self-confinement picture. Now, it's long been recognized that self-confinement only works up to a certain energy. And I'll say now how we estimate that energy. So the self-confinement picture is based on the streaming instability. And the so I've written down the resonance condition, again, ignoring the frequency, because the wave frequency is very small compared to the Doppler shifted frequency of the cosmic rays. So what does this tell us? This tells us that the larger the gyro radius of the cosmic rays, in other words, they're the higher their momentum, the longer the wavelength of the wave they tend to resonate with, but that as mu goes to zero, so as the particle pitch angle goes to 90 degrees, K goes up, becomes very large, goes to infinity. So these waves are amplified by streaming cosmic rays at the rate which can be written like this. So there's a numerical coefficient of order unity out here that depends on the spectrum. This is the proton gyro frequency, non-relativistic. This is the number of cosmic rays, number density of cosmic rays, that can resonate with the wave at all. So there's some minimum momentum corresponding to mu equals 1 that can resonate with the wave. And then as mu gets smaller, p has to be larger. And this is just the thermal ion density. This is the drift, alpha ain't speed, minus 1. So the growth rate is positive if the drift velocity for cosmic rays at that momentum, or average momentum, is greater than the alpha ain't speed. And because the energy spectrum follows a power law, the growth rate declines with cosmic ray energy. So the self-excitation gets weaker as the cosmic ray energy gets higher. Okay. So in a steady state, there has to be some damping mechanism that balances growth. And there are three most important damping mechanisms that have been identified are these. So in weakly ionized gas, there's ion-neutral friction. So the waves propagate in the plasma component, and they damp against the neutral component. And this is typically such a strong effect that it just eliminates the coupling. So this picture, based on frequent scattering from waves, cannot hold up in weakly ionized gas.
And you'll tell us how neutral is.
Oh, well, I'll show you an example, and it can easily be worked out. Okay. In fully ionized regions, there's a nonlinear process called nonlinear Landau damping, in which energy is transferred to the thermal ions. And that's pretty well worked out. And then there's a newer mechanism, originally proposed by Peter Goldreich and one of his students, in which background turbulence in the magnetic field. So everything up to now has had this sort of idealized uniform background field, can kind of shear the wave packets apart. And if we combine the marginal stability condition for all the damping mechanisms in the problem with the relationship between the anisotropy and the pressure gradient that I showed you a bunch of slides back, we can determine the pressure profile and the diffusivity. And we can also determine the maximum energy up to which self-confinement works. And it's between 1 and 200 GeV for Milky Way conditions. But it could be more or it could be less under other conditions, depending on how the background turbulence is driven, the thermal state of the gas, the temperature, and so on.
Sorry, which one dominates in the Milky Way, or is thought to dominate in the Milky Way?
So in the Milky Way, in the weakly ionized clouds, there's basically no confinement. You just can't sustain those fluctuations. So the cosmic rays stream freely. And in the ionized part of the gas, so estimates based on nonlinear Landau damping and on the shearing apart of wave packets actually give kind of similar numbers between 1 and 200 GeV. So they're of comparable importance.
Are you going to talk about other places? One question that came up was whether this is the same balance in, for example, clusters of galaxies, or what would be the dominant balance there?
Right. So in galaxy clusters, so the old work that we did, which was before anybody thought of the shearing mechanism, it was nonlinear Landau damping because you have plasma 10 keV or more, and the rate of nonlinear Landau damping goes as the ion thermal velocity. If you tell me the turbulent spectrum in galaxy clusters, I'll tell you the shearing damping rate, but not right now. Okay. Now. So there are some wrinkles in this picture, and they've been exploited by some people working in the field. So one is that the diffusion theory that I've just described formally breaks down as the particle pitch angle goes to zero. And you can either think of that as it's a Fokker-Planck theory, it's based on small changes, you change direction, that's not a small change. But there's also, as we saw from the resonance condition, particles going at nearly 90 degrees to the magnetic field resonate with very, very short wavelength waves. And those waves can be damped by ion cyclotron damping. That's probably the main mechanism. So the question is, can we apply this theory with this pole at 90 degrees? And I think this was nicely addressed in this old paper by Felice and Kulsrud. Felice and Kulsrud, 1991. And what they worked out quantitatively was a sort of hybrid theory where the cyclotron resonant theory, which I've just described, works up to a very, very tiny value of mu, maybe 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4. And then particles actually get scattered through 90 degrees by mirroring off longer wavelength waves that are scattering cosmic rays with a smaller pitch angle. So their theory can be applied in any medium, and I think it generally suggests that the drift speed is close to the Alphane speed. There are a couple of other potentially important effects. So one is that if the cosmic ray energy density is much larger than the magnetic energy density, so this is thought to be important near supernova shocks, UC over UV greater than C over VD, then the Alphane wave dispersion relation is modified and the growth rates are modified. This is sometimes called the Bell instability. The other modification or wrinkle is that when the plasma beta is very high, something like C over VI squared, so this would happen in a very, very weak magnetic field, the Alphane wave dispersion relation itself is modified. So the waves are not really quite Alphane waves. Okay, so what can we say about the extrinsic turbulence picture? So the MHD cascade itself, the sort of Goldreich-Sridhar cascade, is actually very ineffective at scattering cosmic rays by gyroresonance, and that's because the Goldreich-Sridhar turbulence has a very large k perp compared to k parallel. So the resonant waves oscillate many times over a particle gyro orbit, and this reduces the strength of the interaction. So the interaction with those waves is weak, and so the cascade has to generate some kind of other parasitic wave, like a fast mode wave. But this has been worked out. The consequences of the extrinsic turbulence picture are that the cosmic rays actually extract energy from the background. They don't donate energy to it. So they extract energy by second order Fermi acceleration, and there is no heating term. Just the observations alone, the long confinement times and the low anisotropy, makes it difficult to rule out this picture. So it's an alternative, but I think in any situation you have to look at the strength of the streaming instability and make your best guess about the role of extrinsic turbulence. Okay, so now I'll say something about applications. So one is to galactic winds. And so this is just our simple model of galactic winds. It was developed to explain the soft X-ray emission seen in ROSAT from the galactic center. And it's basically just solving the equations of hydrodynamics, cosmic ray hydrodynamics, along magnetic flux tubes that are perpendicular to the galactic plane and that then fan out. So the magnetic geometry is prescribed. The advantage of this model is that you can make 40,000, however many you want of them, and really do a parameter study. So here's a plot. I don't know how readable this is, probably not very readable. It's a plot of thermal gas pressure versus cosmic ray pressure along these axes. The color represents the mass loss rate in solar masses a year, and the colored region represents the part of parameter space where you can get a wind going. Outside this curved region here, the wind actually boils out of the galactic plane at a supercritical speed. So these are not kind of Parker-type winds. They're more kind of blow-off or evaporative-type winds. And if we're inside the curve, the gas falls back. There's not enough of a force to get it to escape. And the best-fit model is right over here. It corresponds to a couple of solar masses a year. And you can see that cosmic ray pressure and thermal gas pressure are comparable in driving this wind. Yeah?
How much does that depend on what you assume for the magnetic geometry? Because this VL Fane term, does that matter at all for the flux?
So the heating term, so the wind becomes super alphanic fairly close to the galactic plane, but the heating term is quite large. This shows the effect of the heating term. So if we keep the cosmic ray momentum input, but we omit the cosmic ray heating term, then we get this red curve. So in this particular model, here is kind of where the flux tube starts to expand at 100 parsecs above the plane. And so in the absence of heating, the temperature just kind of drops adiabatically. But when you include cosmic ray heating, the temperature actually rises for a while due to the increase in the alphane speed. And then it starts to decay also. But you can see there's a fairly large offset in temperature. So cosmic ray heated winds are hotter than winds without cosmic ray heating.
Just to be clear, when you were saying cosmic ray pressure and gas pressure in the best fit model are comparable.
Yeah.
So you just turned off the cosmic rays. What you would say is still get wind that would be cold. Is that the
So this region is where the gas falls back. So you have to be there is this region here where you can drive. Actually, from here on out, you can drive a thermal wind. But if you're inside this region, then you need cosmic rays. So at least
but
what
if,
you would
if
expect.
If you did drive a thermal wind, it would be colder.
It would be colder. It would be much colder. You can see that. You can see that from this. Okay. So we know that galactic winds are frequently multi-phase. There's hot gas and there's cool gas. And so can cosmic rays, this theory that I showed was for fully ionized gas. And so how do cosmic rays couple to clouds? The answer really is that they don't. Here's a very simple model of how this might take place. So this shows the equilibrium cloud profile. The density goes up, the temperature goes down, and the ionization drops to about 10 to the minus 3. And so we assume in this calculation that outside the cloud, the cosmic rays are streaming down a pressure gradient, a small one. And when they get to the cloud, there's this boundary layer caused by the fact that so to the right of this boundary layer, the cosmic ray density is just constant, because the cosmic rays are not they're not coupled to the gas at all. And the resulting gradient kind of gives the wave pressure one final surge and gives you some heating. So there's a thin heated boundary layer. And you can see that the kind of wave-locked cosmic ray flux and the diffusive flux cross over each other and remain more or less constant. So the upshot of this picture is pretty much what you'd expect, that the cosmic rays do not exert a force on the bulk of the cloud. So cosmic ray driving cannot work for a cool, weakly ionized wind. Josh Wiener, I won't shine the laser on you, did some nice work on cosmic ray heating a year ago. So this is an H-alpha picture of the Milky Way. And there had been, there was a thermal model of the temperature. So this jagged line represents an attempt to reconstruct a pressure profile, a temperature profile perpendicular to the galactic plane over a spiral arm. And the main heating source is thought to be photons from stars in the disk, but they never really explained the full temperature rise, and adding cosmic ray heating according to parameters as we think we know them produces this very nice curve. So it seems to be a supplemental heating model for warm ionized gas. Okay, so I want to spend the last few minutes talking about some work by my student, Toby Yost Hull, where we try to see what cosmic rays can, first of all, whether cosmic rays in other galaxies behave kind of the same as they do in the Milky Way, and what we can learn about other galaxies if they do. So the basic idea was that we looked at galaxies that had been detected with Fermi, so they are known to emit gamma rays. Galaxies with well-defined or well-estimated supernova rates or star formation rates, so we can estimate the cosmic ray production rate, assuming that it scales in the Milky Way, about 10% of supernova energy goes into cosmic rays. We can take what's known about the interstellar medium of the galaxy, and we can try to predict the spectrum. We can ask whether these galaxies are calorimeters, in other words, whether all the cosmic ray energy is expended within the galaxy, and whether we can learn anything about these galaxies by matching the spectrum. Okay, so here are two fits to the gamma ray spectrum of M82. So these blue points are at lower energy are Fermi, and the red points are Veritas. And there are two different models presented here. So this is the model that best fits the gamma ray emission in the sense that it's a minimum chi squared. And this is the model that best fits the radio spectrum, again, in chi squared. And because there's and here's the radio spectrum, so there's a lot of radio data, and we actually get a very good fit to it. Over a big range in frequencies. And then because it's a relatively simple model that has only a few parameters, we can run many, many such models and try to minimize chi squared within parameter space. So here's one attempt to do that for wind speed. So this is the wind speed in kilometers a second, and this is the magnetic field strength in microgauss between 50 and 350. And the minimum chi squared is in blue. And you can see that there's this trade-off between wind speed and magnetic field strength. And the main reason for this trade-off is that the more the wind speed increases, the larger the effective losses of the cosmic rays. So to get a fixed amount of synchrotron radiation, you have to drive up the magnetic field strength. So we also looked at primary cosmic ray spectral index, properties of the ionized gas, and so on. These are the best fits that we came up with. And the implications are that M82 is an excellent electron calorimeter. So basically, all the cosmic ray electron energy is expended within the galaxy to inverse Compton, synchrotron, ionization losses before escaping. But the proton losses in the galaxy and advective losses are comparable. So it's about a 50% proton calorimeter. Yeah?
Just real quick, the font didn't work, but that's 275 micrograms.
Yeah, I don't know why it's didn't introduce. Yeah, 275 micrograms. Go ahead.
How important are secondary electrons?
They're really important. I'm glad you asked that. So in the Milky Way, pretty much all the synchrotron radiation that we see is from primary cosmic ray electrons. But in M82, there's so much electron-positron production by collisions that actually about two-thirds of the electron emissions are from secondaries. So the electron and proton cosmic ray populations are coupled in this way. So as you make the interstellar medium denser, you get more synchrotron radiation.
Presumably, those models have pion bump in them or not?
So our energy loss mechanisms have, there's a big bump due to onset of pion production.
Okay, so that doesn't.
Well, if you look at the spectrum.
Like you say, you had two different models.
Yeah.
What are you changing?
Well, the physics is all the same. Okay, so here, So this is the gamma ray spectrum. The primary cosmic ray spectral index is 2.1. The molecular mass is 400 million solar masses. The magnetic field is 275 microgauss. The advection speed is 500 kilometers a second. So this is kind of representative of the this advection speed of the emission line, but not of the hot X-ray gas. That's actually, yeah, that was kind of a puzzle to me. And an ion density of about 100.
So that, okay. That's like right in the center of the galaxy.
This is in the starburst region. So it's a region 1-200 kiloparsecs.
That's still really
hot. Well, you know, M82 is kind of like the Milky Way on steroids. I mean, you take any property of the...
Well, the surface densities are higher, the number densities are higher, but I don't remember, I mean, this is right where...
Star formation rate is higher.
Star formation factor 3 or 4 or 5.
Averaged over the whole disk. But if you just look, no, if you compare the size of the Milky Way disk with the size of the starburst region, and then the radio, the best fit to the radio spectrum is a slightly steeper primary source, 2.2, same molecular mass, magnetic field. I can read it from my screen.
It's pretty similar,
but not exactly the same. And you can see that this model does a better job at the Veritas data than this model. So yeah, I mean, the fact that you can't fit both data sets, that the best model for both data sets is not the same. I mean, they're similar, but they're not exactly the same.
Interesting. I guess the model, the gas is leaving. So you're having gas that's going at high velocity and gas that's...
It does surprise me in the sense that the filling factor for the dense gas is quite low. So you might think that, you know, most of the stuff would be flowing out at the higher speed. So how could you avoid this? Well, you can make the magnetic field stronger, but it's already quite strong.
Are there any direct measurements? I'm just trying to do...
No, not yet. AMMAO wants to do some direct measurements.
Because it's high, but not ridiculous. I mean, if you can do...
It's higher than that, right?
It's like 5 or whatever.
It's high but not ridiculous. Okay, so just put up my conclusions. So because of the long confinement times and near isotropy of cosmic rays, we think they're well described by a fluid picture. And there's this self-confinement theory in which cosmic rays produce the fluctuations that scatter them. This is entirely a theory. There's no lab evidence for it, and it's not tested by numerical simulations, although I understand that Jim and his coworkers are working on this, so that will be good. And I've kind of run by you some of the details in the implementation that make it hard to be fully deterministic, but I guess my view is that many things in this game are parameterized, and we can do the same for the role of cosmic rays. And we can apply them to driving galactic winds, to heating, to the intercluster medium, et cetera. And to some extent, we can test the generality of the acceleration and confinement theory in other galaxies.
So I mean, people are, there's at least some people who want to produce winds from Euler extend these outflows of cold gas via cosmic ray acceleration. But you showed this calculation you did with John that said it doesn't couple to this cold cloud. So you think that's at all feasible for Euler's? Other star forming galaxies?
So you have to look at the parameters. So if you have an enormous flux of cosmic rays, then the growth rates are higher. I actually looked at this a long time ago with Mike Shull, sort of a molecular cloud environment, and there are some very extreme conditions. If you can sort of point me to a paper I'd love to see what parameters they're actually using and try to estimate something like that. Our experience with this cloud model, which was an ionization fraction of 10 to minus 3, is that the waves are just completely wiped out.
So 1%,
that's actually more like a 1% ionized or 1% neutral?
1% ionized. You said 10 to minus 3 ionized fraction.
Yeah.
So supposing like 1%, is that enough?
I don't think so.
If there's any field around at all, it's going to scatter on the turbulent.
Well, then the question is, do you expect molecular clouds to have turbulence of this wavelength within them? And again, they can be driven, if there's some source which is driving them. But most estimates of MHD turbulence in molecular clouds predict that it sort of drops out at tens or hundreds of AU, which is much longer than the relevant cosmic ray. But again, sorry, what?
Tens of hundreds of AU?
To drop out for MHD turbulence. So
where,
if you...
Where does it come from? The sonic length is much larger than that.
Sorry, the turbulence decays on a larger scale or a smaller scale?
I said sonic.
The sonic length is much larger than transponder than you.
So the turbulence makes a transition from being from both the plasma and the neutrals taking part in it to just living in the plasma. And so, in a sense, there are sort of two cascades. There's the fully coupled MHD cascade. Then there's a very strongly damped region. And then there's whatever tunnels through on the shorter scales. It's also possible, it depends on the... So the resistivity is typically still very low. It's also possible to drive fluctuations in the magnetic field with velocities that are on a much larger scale. But the efficiency of those fluctuations for scattering cosmic rays has actually never been discussed.
So I guess in a Euler environment, the idea would be that all the cosmic rays just stream out without scattering very much.
Well, so they...
These are essentially giant molecular clouds. Right?
They look like they're pretty neutral.
This coupling, so there's momentum coupling and there's energy coupling. And in order to get both the momentum driving and the energy driving, you need self-consistently generated turbulence. If you have something around for them to scatter from, then you can deposit momentum, but not necessarily energy.
There's certainly plenty of turbulence. On large scales.
On large scales, yeah. So then the question is I think it would be interesting to think about it some more, because you might have mirroring, which
you will certainly
also
But that goes a long way, right?
Well, so mirroring, so second order Fermi acceleration won't help you, but I guess the question is it seems to me that if you have if you have a beam of cosmic rays and they're scattering off anything, there will tend to be a transfer of momentum in the direction of the beam.
So Pang had given a discussion earlier, and he had pointed out the same thing you did in the beginning, which was that there's this long power law for Frank's include the medium or the turbulence.
The first one is the
medium. The medium, okay. Well, it should be, I guess.
It's straighter than you can possibly keep your leg. But nevertheless, people try to explain it.
Right. But the energy you were talking about was 100 GeV for the...
So the mean energy, so I think if you're interested in the coupling, the feedback of cosmic rays on their environment, it's particles of a few GeV.
No, that'll make sense. Yeah. But I thought, so the point that he was making, I thought, if I remember correctly, was, that if this self-confinement picture were really the case, as opposed to coupling the energy or momentum,
yeah.
that
That's a different question.
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't go to high enough energies to produce this.
No. There is some recent work by Blasi in which he identifies some tiny feature in the spectrum at around 1 or 200 GeV, and he says that's the transition in propagation. But the actual origin of the Ni has not yet been explained. It's a higher energy than can be produced by supernovae. It seems to fail by about an order of magnitude, although people have been really trying to push it up for years. So it's not really, the Ni is probably associated with a change in composition. Again, that's not really clear.
So, but I guess then I want to get back to Nick's question now, right? This time scale, N million years, as you said, it's inferred from looking at the composition of things.
Isotopic composition,
things with
boron,
finite, some radioactive component in there. So you look at that decay time scale. And then it's coupled with the observation that they're isotropic, so they're coming from all directions. So you think they're coming from fairly far away.
There seem to be many scatterings between the source and us.
And so now you just calculate the lifetime of those things and say they've been scattering around, and because they're coming from, as you say, they've scattered many, many times, so it's isotropic. That's how they get a lifetime out of their
I figured it out.
What's that?
I figured it out.
Okay.
So the 20 million years, right, it's a time between the cosmic ray being ejected and hitting the Earth's atmosphere, which presumably a random place in the galaxy component of cosmic.
Exactly.
Means that it leaves at least 20 million years. So 20 million years is actually a lower limit on the companion time. But if the companion time was, say, 100 billion years, and most cosmic rays would be 100 billion years old, and that's not what the composition shows.
Right.
So it cannot be much larger than 20 million years as well.
Exactly.
So I think that's the reason for that.
Good.
So it's a lower limit, but the upper limit cannot be much larger than 20 million years, because then we'll find many more, much older ones.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
So those cosmic rays that they're measuring, these isotopic ratios, are probably the low energy guys, right?
Because
I'm still wondering about this question about if you're trying to confine these things, that they follow a power law. The power laws, the confinement time varies as you change.
The confinement time decreases, and it's a small fractional power of the energy.
Right, but if this feature at a few hundred GeV is supposed to be the signature of this.
That's very expensive.
And the feature may not even be there. Yeah. I'm still trying to understand what sets the power law to much higher energy. It's got nothing to do with confinement though, in that case, right? Why is it roughly the same power law?
So the highest energy cosmic rays, I'm not sure this is what you're asking, but the highest energy cosmic rays are not confined by the galactic
Right. Above about 10 to 18. Right. No. I'm talking about things between the Ni and 100 GeV, basically. Right.
Yeah.
There's roughly a power law for a few.
Yeah. E to minus 2.6. Or
something. Yeah. Exactly.
The problem is those things are still pretty isotropic, aren't they?
They're very isotropic.
That's the question I'm asking. How does that work? Because there's something else that's got to be doing isotropizing.
Well, so they're scattering from something.
Right. But apparently not.
They're scattering from something, but it's not waves they make themselves.
Right. Okay. So that's the point.
But it's still hard to explain why that would map onto the self-excited Alfvén wave power law if they were different mechanisms, right? That's why you want turbulence to be doing all of it.
That's an argument for turbulence doing all of it. On the other hand, what happens to the speed of instability? I mean, we know it's there.
Right.
It's short wavelength.
Wasn't Lazarian saying it can all be explained just by magnetosonic turbulence?
So he has argued that, so the turbulent cascade is too anisotropic, it doesn't scatter efficiently. But there is some, due to compressibility effects, there is some production of magnetosonic waves. And they've argued, but they haven't actually said what happens to the streaming instability.
And these
These rays are, again, these very small scales you're talking about.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, so these are like a year or so that I'm using this.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.